Weekly with James Richardson.
On today's Football Weekly, the Carling Cup final. Two down and three to go for Manchester United's quintuple and a bright future for the club in foster care. The Premier League, Liverpool, with their skirtle out of place, everyone can see their pants. As Rafa's challenge ends at the Riverside, we ask, can anything trouble Sir Alex's sleep this season? Apart, that is, from the troubling knowledge of what Rio Ferdinand wants to do with an owl this August. Abroad, there's Sid on Spain, where the Barca disaster continues. Italy, with one in the eye for Palermo from, appropriately enough, Mascara. And Herr Honigstein with the Bundesliga, which couldn't be more wide open if they were a tart's legs when the Navy's in town. All that plus your post and a look forward to the midweek Premier League action in today's Football Weekly. Hello all. You join us today in a spanking new pod. It's quite exciting, actually, in which we find our partners in pod, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Of theguardian.co.uk. A similar provenance for John Ashdown.
Hello.
Hi, John. And, excitingly, we have the Süddeutsche Zeitung's Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hi, Rafa. Excellent. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Everybody else as well?
So it's quite big in here, isn't it?
It is big.
We've moved on to this space age type pod.
Yes.
We humble origins were a cupboard with bits of felt stuck to the wall in old Guardian Towers. Now we've got huge glass windows, lights hanging out of the ceiling. Like proper studio lights.
We're entering the prog rock Jazz Odyssey.
And we started our debut in here by arguing over whether a tart's legs would be wide open or wide apart, or her knees or her legs would be wide open.
Or wider. Would it be wider?
You can put us anywhere, but we'll always lower the tone.
Yes, indeed. And, the Carling Cup final. It's over. The Carling Cup is over for another year. Huzzah. Did anyone watch the final? John Ashton.
No, it was on in the office while I was working on other things.
It's good enough.
So I saw glimpses of it. It didn't look like a classic, and by all accounts it wasn't.
It was at Wembley, and finals at Wembley, since they rebuilt the place, have been uniformly rubbish.
Games at Wembley have been fairly poor. The last two FA Cup finals since it was rebuilt were both 1-0. Last year's Carling Cup final wasn't much to write home about. Even the two playoff finals for the last 2 years in the Championship have been 1-0, fairly dry affairs.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's just one of those things. It's just a patch, isn't it? I'm told that the first ever game between Wembley was between
3-3.
Well, that was the first official game. Before that, the stadium staff played the builders' multiplex in a sort of kickabout, and apparently that was a dire 0-0. Yes, solved on a penalty scored.
Well,
by
I'm
the
not
bloke.
Surprised that the builders had problems with their finishing. Hey,
that was an open goal, James.
Are you suggesting, James, that has something to do with the stadium, that the matches have been rubbish?
I don't see why not. I think it's interesting as we settle into our new environs today to note how overimposing architecture can often impede performance.
Well, I'm now sitting so far away from you that I could barely see you. Honigstein is a
But there are things that might impede performance as well. I did want to talk just briefly about the Carling Cup final. Yes,
I don't think there's much to say about it, apart from the fact that Ben Foster was listening to Football Weekly on his iPod before the penalty shootout, and that's what helped him save the penalty. The Spurs
saved one
penalties were pretty abysmal.
Right.
Darren Bent didn't take one for some strange reason or other.
I thought there's a quote from Foster afterwards that I thought was quite interesting. He said that the iPod is an innovation that Eric Steele brought here when he joined United from Blackburn in the summer. Which just sort of sounds like, oh, Mr. Steele, what's this magic box you bring over to where?
Well, John, I don't know if you've been up north, but they are.
Well, I imagine that Ben Foster is a West Country old folk type. Which I thought was quite interesting. And Eric Steele, as an aside, used to live next door to one of my best friends at school.
Right.
And used to own a pub in a village where my mum works in a post office.
Was he the talk of the village with his electronic trickery?
He revolutionised the
future.
He brought these pumps for dispensing beer and all sorts. It was incredible.
I think it is quite telling, though, that United bring out an iPod that has the Spurs, or some of the Spurs players taking penalties, whereas Spurs never thought it was necessary to train penalties at all. Yeah. I'm sure Redknapp was lining up a couple of deals for the summer rather than training.
Harry has a man on his backroom staff who had a cassette recorder, which just had a voice telling.
But, I mean, although in the end they lost, is it not credit to Spurs that they managed to hold the mighty United to 120 goalless minutes?
The United B team, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Fair enough, then. Two down, three to go, as we mentioned. And the Premier League looks like a bit of a given now, thanks to Liverpool's brave efforts at the Riverside.
Which you called, Jimbo.
And sort of.
Sort of. Well, you called it as a draw in the pod, but before the pod, you had actually said to me you reckoned Middlesbrough were going to win. And loath as I am to give you credit, I don't know why you bottled out of that and went for the draw hedged in the actual pod.
He also predicted a Liverpool win in a conversation with me.
He had all the bases covered.
The Guardian had a nice open thread about where did it all go wrong for Liverpool? Where did the title race...
The answer is easy, isn't it? It's the anti-Liverpool bias in the media.
That's the answer. Because I didn't want... I mean, I remember at the time of Rafa's rant that we did kind of poo-poo potential impact of this. But you have to look at the results since. And they've had, what, seven games? Only won two of them, Liverpool. Manchester United, over the same form, have won every single game. And as a result, have moved from eight points behind to 7 points clear in front, which is pretty remarkable with a game in hand.
Well, it could be argued that it all went pear-shaped for them since they sold Robbie Keane.
Well, it was already going. It was already taking on the form of said fruit.
I mean,
even
there's so many
Robbie
factors. They've had injuries. They've got backroom staff who can't stand the sight of each other, one of whom is now gone.
Or will be going.
Will be going. Mm. Well, I presume, is he on gardening leave or now? Or
well, he was at the stadium.
Yeah, I think he's still there.
But there you go. At the Riverside, John, the finger of blame was being pointed at Rafa Benitez for his decision to field Martin Skrtel in the right-back position.
Yeah, which is where, you'd expect Jamie Carragher to fill in if need be. I thought it was slightly unfair. I know Skrtel had a bad game and Downing had one of his, or was certainly made to look to have one of his best games in a Borough shirt. But I don't think that either goal was a result of Skrtel playing at right-back. The first goal was a result of him missing a header that he would have missed. It wasn't based on what position he was playing in. And the second goal came down the left, so I feel it slightly unfair that the finger gets pointed in his direction.
Well, that man Hansom, I think his contention was that because Skrtel was so woeful at right back that everybody else was pulled out of position.
Well, that's one thing. But what does he know about defending?
Well, indeed. But is Benitez to blame? Can we blame it all on Rafa?
Not all of it. I mean, they're obviously working within the constraints of budget that they shouldn't be in a position to compete with United and Chelsea. Just in terms
of... But with Borough would be nice.
Yeah. I think that the main problem, if you want, is the same every year, that this team and the way that Benitez thinks, it's about controlling games, it's about stifling the opposition. It's a perfect system for Europe where you can go through on away goals, you can go through by restricting or destroying your opposition's game. In the Premier League, you have to grind out these wins against lesser sides, and Liverpool time and time again come up short. Nothing's really changed.
Do you think Benitez, because he is ultimately Spanish, doesn't actually care about the Premier League deep down? He only cares about proving himself on a European stage.
No. I think he really does care. And I think he really this year felt that they were going to do it and really give it a go, because the Champions League is not something you can concentrate on as such. I mean, you have knockout games and one bad game and you're out. You know, the fact that you somehow concentrated your mind for 10 months on it doesn't really...
No,
can make any difference.
Influence your selection. But,
yeah, but that's not really been the problem for them. The problem is that, A, in the final analysis, again, the squad is not quite good enough. And B, I think it's been the cautious nature of Rafa that he, time and time again, struggles in the Premier League. I mean, last summer he was saying the problem in the Premier League is that you can't control games. There's too many 50-50s and you don't know what's going on. Whereas in Europe, you pick your team and you know the opposition, and the inference is that
you can... It should be the other way around, though, shouldn't it? It should be more unknowns in the European game than there are in the...
Yeah, but what he's saying is because of the nature of the game and you have all these second balls and you can't always calculate the outcome. You know, Benitez sits down with a calculator and calculates moves and possession and stats and everything. And in Europe, it works much better because the game is more controlled. And... You know, that's been his explanation. I think he's going to say the same again this year.
I'm amazed because, for example, the famous Istanbul final, his hypothesis, if you like, was the least controlled game I've ever seen.
That is true.
But if you go way, 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 way back to the start of the season, Liverpool were playing very badly and getting results, which is something they're unable to do now.
Now they just play badly.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, you know... That's where, which is kind of a worry for the fans, because they may not have a better chance to win the league than they've had this season.
But you are right, I think, Barry, that the Robbie Keane thing is still puzzling in many ways. And you think, you know, they said he had a negative influence, but still there was another body up front, another striker. And there's so much pressure on Torres and I guess Coit as well to deliver, and no one else really to back them up, that's ultimately cost them as well.
Right. Well, in the meantime, Liverpool are now out of second place, and that is a big blow to them, though, because the difference between second and third, you have to do qualifying games.
No, not anymore, not next season.
So second and third both have to do qualifying.
Good. No. First three go straight in. Yes.
All right, then, excellent. probably chop that bit, eh?
Or it's not a good point, eh? Though, because about fourth, because fourth is a lot less attractive this year, because you have to play a better team.
Right. Chances. There are only 3 points off fourth, Rafa, and that would make a huge difference. Aston Villa there, of course. Excellent. Well, we'll talk more about Liverpool and the midweek round of games later on. Do we have time in this part one, I wonder, to quickly have a look at the situation at the bottom, which is much more interesting. All of a sudden, you've got that logjam going on again. Six teams crowded into just 2 points. From Spurs down to Stoke. Spurs do have a game in hand. Rovers are out of the bottom three. That was the big news from the weekend. Hull, their miserable form continues, just one win in 17. And for a club that seemed to base its success around the players enjoying themselves, worryingly signs of dissent from Giovanni as he came off in the game against Blackburn.
I just thought Phil Brown's quotes afterwards, they seemed a bit archaic in the way he was sort of, oh, he's never going to do that to me again, and you know, he's not bigger than this football club. And it just seemed like you don't hear managers saying that anymore. It sort of seems like phrases from another era. Because what does Giovanni care what Phil Brown thinks? I mean, that's what Phil Brown clearly thinks, that his players, you know, because he's the sort of slightly maybe an old school manager in a way, his players are showing loyalty to the club and will show loyalty to him. But Giovanni's got a cap for Brazil and he's played for Barcelona. Why should he give a monkeys about Phil Brown? I don't understand.
He wants to play, surely.
Well, yeah, of course he wants to. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Giovanni will leave at the end of the season if he wants to, and he won't give it a second thought. I mean, it just seems a strange way to try and motivate somebody to sort of come out with sort
does
of slightly.
Does he not have to talk that way in front of the rest of the team? Does he not have to adopt that?
Well, he can do it. He can do it in the dressing room. I don't know why he has to do it in the press.
Yeah. Why couldn't he do it out in the centre circle?
Well, exactly. Yeah, just do it as he came off the pitch.
I thought it was stranger in the sense that when he was saying no one's bigger at this, no one's bigger than the football club. He really was saying, I'm bigger than the football club. I mean, that's how it sounded to me.
Right.
And that
Mark
didn't come Kaduka across.
Mark is bigger than the football club, but he's not at all. So.
Right. He is at Newcastle.
I have noticed, actually, history is on Hull's side. They are in free fall, but because John was coming in to today's pod, I thought I better outstat him or make a bid to outstat him.
All right, let's have a stat off. What have you got?
Well, Hull are 13th at the moment, and no team higher than 14th has ever gone down. If they've been 14th this day, this is, you know, on the 2nd of March, they've never. Norwich went down once. They were 14th on the 2nd of March and they went down. And Wimbledon and Ipswich both went down, having been 15th on this day of that particular season.
Ball's in your court, John.
I can't even respond to that. It's far in excess of my paltry record numbers of record low tallies and record high tallies of staying up. I might just have to do a sort of dance.
You've been served, actually.
Okay. Well, just to wrap up the business at the bottom then, Newcastle, who I was trying to move on to there with that Vituka business, they've got more woes ahead because they've got a terrible run of fixtures, haven't they? And they've got Man United midweek.
They've Man United coming up. They've Arsenal, Chelsea, Hull and Stoke City. So they've a couple of six-pointers and several no-pointers coming up, you'd have to think.
Right.
I saw them yesterday. I did the minute-by-minute of their game against Bolton. It was quite an entertaining game, but the quality of football on show was dismal and Newcastle were appalling.
Bolton pick up another win. They're now into the top half of the Premier League. This club was in last place when Gary Megson took over not so long ago. Why is he still so unpopular with the Bolton fans?
I think his demeanour doesn't do him any favours.
He always looks quite cheery.
He's quite dour looking, and he I don't know. The brand of football his teams play is vile to watch, but you would think Bolton fans would be used to that, having had Sam Allardyce, who was the godfather of prehistoric football, in charge of their team. But I don't know if it's just the style of football or Megson's manner. I mean, I've told the story before that a friend of mine played under him at Stockport County and none of the players liked him at all. They really couldn't stand him. I'm not sure.
Well, Bolton are away at Stoke midweek. We'll have more on that later on. And more, of course, on all these stories and previews, etc., at guardian.co.uk. But in a second or two, we're going to be turning our attention to events this weekend in Europe. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Hi, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. What an exciting weekend you've been having in the Liga.
Fantastic. Really, really great fun last night being at the Vicente Calderon for Atletico against Barcelona, which tends to be a fantastic game anyway. But last night was, I think, probably even better. Back in the 90s, they used to talk about this being the game in Spain. And there was a period certainly when Bobby Robson was at Barcelona. I remember a 5-4 in the Copa del Rey. And between Barcelona and Atletico Madrid, since Atletico have come back into the first division, their games have turned up an average of 3.5 goals. Well, last night there were 7 goals for the second time this season between the two teams. But rather than the 6-1 that Barcelona absolutely tonked Atletico with earlier in the season, it was 4-3 to Atletico with a last-minute winner. It was just sensational. Two teams who can't defend to save their lives, who don't really play a huge amount of football in the middle of the pitch, or didn't last night anyway, but who have fantastic forwards. It was really, really good fun.
And Aguero back on the score sheet. He hadn't scored for a while, had he?
He hadn't scored for a while. Of course, he's just become a father, and there's been lots of suggestions that perhaps he's not as committed as he should be. He was very, very irritated at being taken off in the Champions League in midweek. Lots of talk about him leaving at the end of the season, and he was absolutely fantastic last night. Yet again, I suppose you could talk about it being Messi against Aguero, and today everybody's agreed that Aguero came out on top. But I think in a way, only because Atletico did, because I thought Messi in patches was brilliant as well. Scored a fantastic goal.
You mentioned the stories of him leaving at the end of the season. The Italian papers have been full of suggestions that he might even end up at Inter. Why would Atletico let him go, or are they just not financially liquid enough to retain his services?
Well, that's exactly the point. Ultimately, Atletico won't be able to stop him. His buyout clause, I think, is now €59 million, which, of course, is more than payable for a really, really big club. Atletico Madrid have terrible financial problems. They've got an embargo on them from the state in Spain because, of course, they still owe the tax man. I think it's something like €15 million. They didn't even get all the money they got for Fernando Torres because they had to give some of it over to the tax man. So they're in a difficult position. On top of that, you've got the fact that Aguero himself may well decide, as I'm sure a lot of people will recognise, that maybe Atletico are not big enough for him. Certainly that's what Fernando Torres felt, because the club is a shambles on the inside. It really is. So I think Aguero wants to walk away. And of course, he's got a certain Diego Maradona, father-in-law and international coach, telling him that hanging around at Atleti isn't such a good idea.
Sid, what's gone wrong for Barcelona in recent weeks? Is there anything you can really point your finger on? Is it just a coincidence of bad results? Or?
Well, I think there's a few things. Trying to work this out yesterday, watching them, and they really were poor yesterday. I mean, they didn't control the ball as they have done in previous weeks. They weren't the good side they have been. Speaking to Ida Johnson after the game, he was saying, "Well, look, I don't really know." He claimed that maybe things had gone a little bit too well earlier in the season, which implies that there's a little bit of complacency. I think there are a number of factors. I think one of them is the fact that that yes, there was a bit of complacency. The other one is that we're now in the second half of the season. Every team is playing them for the second time, has had experience of them, maybe knows how to handle them better. I think as well, if you look at it, that they, you know, Real Madrid have played a game every 7 days since the turn of the year. Barcelona have played a game every 3 days. I think they're tired. I really do think they're tired, despite the rotations. I also think there's a little bit of anxiety at seeing Real Madrid get closer to them, although obviously at first it seemed ridiculous to talk about fear for Barcelona because they were 10 or 12 points clear. But bit by bit, that started to come in.
Just four points now, Sid.
And this is the thing, you know, it seems like a ridiculous campaign from the Madrid press, but it's turned out they've been right, because they've been saying, oh, we're closing back gap on Barcelona for the last 3 weeks. And he said, yeah, well done, boys, you've closed the gap to 10 points. Well, all of a sudden, hang on a minute, 4 points, and it really is closing the gap now. There's a couple of other factors. I think one of them is that when you looked at the fixture list, these 3 weeks were always going to be the 3 weeks when it was hardest for Barcelona. Because if you look at the fixture list, because, you know, the second that you see the league as a kind of, if you like, a pursuit, Real Madrid pursuing Barcelona, then you have to start looking at it week by week in terms of fixtures. And these last 3 weeks have been, I think, the only 3 weeks for the rest of the season, when you look at it and you think that is a week in which Madrid's fixtures is better than Barcelona's. The thing is, of course, Barcelona needed to come through it, and they haven't done, so that changes the mindset. Obviously, losing away to Atletico Madrid is nothing particularly new. Drawing away at Betis is not a disastrous result. Losing at home against Espanyol, all right, losing at home was a real shock because they hadn't won there, and, you know, hadn't been beaten in 28 years. But they have drawn in recent years with Espanyol, so perhaps it's not that dramatic. But I think they're off the boil. I think they're not as fresh as they were. They're not as strong as they were. And now's a real test of Guardiola, because, of course, we were all raving about him, and I include myself in that. Now we have to see to what extent he can deal with an adverse situation as well as a very good one.
Who's the pooch, Sid?
The pooch is in the background running after a toy.
Is it a Shan Andalou, is it?
What?
Oh, never mind. I've just been...
What's a Shan Andalou?
Never
that
mind.
That sounds like a curry dish to me.
I don't want to go to your local Indian. Sid, we look forward to hearing more from you then on Thursday, possibly looking forward to that big game in Madrid.
Fantastic. Thank you then.
Thanks, Sid. There you go, dogs.
Mm. What, a dog barking?
Yes.
Not that bizarre.
Yeah, the curious case of the dog that barked.
If he had mooed or gone baa, then right. It would be bizarre.
It's a fair point that Barry makes, actually.
But then how would we have known it was a dog?
We could have asked.
All right, okay.
James would have said, why is there a sheep in the background? And Sid would have gone, it's not a sheep, it's a dog.
Right.
And then, you know.
None of which happened.
Comedy would have ensued.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Probably not in this podcast.
Right.
We would have managed to make it sound pedestrian and unfunny.
Right. Posts. Can anyone explain the 6+5 rule? And is it all about to happen now after this weekend's events? John Ashdown.
I did 5 minutes of research beforehand. And according to FIFA, the definition of the 6+5 rule is at the beginning of each match, each club must field at least six who are players eligible to play for the national team of the country of the
From
club.
Your starting 11?
In the starting 11, and it's not restricted to substitutes. So by the end of the match, you could have a 3+8 situation.
Right.
And the calendar for bringing it in is they're going to move to a 4+7 in 2010-2011, 5+6 the season after, and then 6+5 would come in for the 2012-2013 season.
Right. Because originally this was going to be about players who'd come through, or certainly in terms of the UEFA ruling that's currently in place regarding the number of homegrown Champions League players that you have to have in your Champions League squad. That's all about going through the youth programme,
isn't it?
It's the
local players.
Yeah.
15
what about
to 21.
Irish players, Scottish players and Welsh players? I presume it includes them as well.
Well, yeah. It was Matthias who posted in asking this question and says, what about Swansea and Cardiff, who are Welsh teams playing in English League? Would their six home nation players have to be English, or would they be allowed to be Welsh?
I'm sure Sepp Blatter has thought it all through very, very carefully and taken all these factors into account.
All right. They had a big meeting, FIFA, this week, in which they moved closer to bringing in goal line judges. There's a chance that might be happening next season in the Championship.
Yeah, that was mooted, yeah.
There you go.
But, I mean, they have goal-line judges in Gaelic games, hurling and Gaelic football, umpires. And if it's a goal, they wave a green flag. If it's a point over the bar, they wave a white flag. And they often make mistakes as well.
So. Well, indeed. They're only human, born to make mistakes.
Said Phil Oakey.
He did indeed. Blue Jock, thanks for your little note about the Bombay Derby match, Mumbai FC against Air India. Very good. Rafa, the Bundesliga, Hertha Berlin are now on top, and there's a Liverpool player who's still got title ambitions.
Yes, indeed. The wonderful ponytailed Andrei Voronin scored again, and somehow Hertha, from being a bit of a joke, there are serious title contenders, as are a host of other teams you didn't expect before the beginning of the season, like Hoffenheim, but even like Wolfsburg, who beat Hamburg away 3-1 on Sunday and are suddenly pressurising Bayern, who are only in fifth. So it's an incredibly open and unpredictable league. So
could you put this in context for us, Rafa? What would the English equivalent say of this Bundesliga table be at this time of the year?
Well, I suppose Hertha being up there would be a bit like Middlesbrough.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Hertha, of course, from a capital city and big stadium, etc. But in terms of the size of the club or their success in recent years, they are very, very, you know, they're very, very average. Wolfsburg, an interesting case, because they've actually spent more money than anyone else in the Bundesliga. They are effectively owned by Volkswagen. It's an anomaly in the German system. because usually the clubs are not allowed to have any investment, but because they were founded as a club by the workers at the Volkswagen plant, a bit like Bayer Leverkusen, there's always been an exception. So, you know, all of a sudden, if you want, they are actually fulfilling their potential. They've spent 30 million euros in the transfer market, and they bought a lot of really good and useful players. And it's also interesting because Felix Magath is one of the few managers, I suppose, along with Ralf Rangnick, who's really following the English model, where the manager is sort of the omnipotent figure who's also a sporting director. With Magath, he's also actually the CEO of the club as well. So he's doing he's doing all the jobs. And it's quite incredible, really, just how well they've done.
Five teams then in within 4 points of each other at the top. How many of those are realistic title candidates?
Well, you still wait for Hertha's bubble to burst, but so far it hasn't. They are really not very good to watch. They're very unattractive, but they grind out results, and that's been their strength, their secret. The Bundesliga this year is characteristic for a lot of attacking football, with perhaps the defensive side of things not that developed. Or, you know, you think of German football, you like to think of it as very organised, etc. It's been the complete opposite. Everybody's good going forward, not so good at the back. Hertha are the other way around. They grind up results, and that's why they're top. Hamburg is still looking good despite the defeat. I still think they're the most likely contenders. And of course, you've got Hoffenheim and Bayern. So, it's a fantastic league in terms of the unpredictability and the number of teams involved.
Brilliant. Rafa, just one other thing. Werder Bremen beating Milan in the UEFA Cup. A lot of people had Milan down as one of the favourites for that competition. And Werder now through alongside Hamburg, Zenit St. Petersburg and CSKA Moscow. Is it kind of Germany and Russia the only two nations that are really, really taking this tournament seriously, by the looks of it?
I think there's also three Ukrainian sides still involved. Yeah, two of them play each other. But there's three Ukrainians, two Russians, and two Germans. The German sides always take it very seriously, I have to say. And Stuttgart were very...
Germans take everything very seriously.
Probably, yes. Stuttgart were very upset that they were beaten. And as you said, Werder really pulled off the result, because with 30 minutes to go, they were actually 2-0 down away to Milan. They needed 2-2 draw to go through on away goals, and Claudio Pizarro scored twice. And then afterwards, all the Italian press was saying this is the right outcome. Werder were much a better side despite the 2-0 lead for Milan. And it was an incredible result. And it really, you could see even in the game against Bayern, which on Sunday they had to play for 75 minutes with one man down because they had Naldo sent off for a red card offence. That result has brought a lot of confidence back to this Werder side. I mean, they're still only in 11th. They're having the worst season in probably a decade. But that one result has given them a bit of a foothold into the season. And it was a great result and a fantastic performance from Diego, which really put himself in the shop window.
Indeed so.
And did a poster point out that's the last we'll see of Paolo Maldini in Europe, which is a bit sad.
And it is David a bit, Beckham, really. Which might not be so sad.
Well, he might turn up somewhere else, you never know. Or next
season.
Well, not this season. No, but Paolo Maldini is retiring at the end of the season.
Paolo Maldini,
and he went out holding his finger to his lips to say shush to the Milan fans who were expressing their disapproval. So it is a sad way for the curtain to come down.
He was also directly at fault for at least one of the two goals. He just completely switched off for a free kick, and that Pizarro had the ball in completely unchallenged.
I knew he'd get found out eventually.
Well, thanks to Here We Go, who was posting in on that very subject of Milan and the UEFA Cup in general. If you, like Here We Go, want to comment, guardian.co.uk/football, then the Football Weekly page is the place to do it, or find us on Facebook. In a second or two, we're going to be finding out more about Milan's misery with the latest from Serie A, Paolo Bandini, standing by. And we'll also be continuing. I look forward to the excitements in the Premier League midweek.
Football Weekly with James Richardson on guardian.co.uk.
Now, okay, part three, which means Paolo Bandini on everybody's favourite foreign league, Serie A. Hi, Paolo.
Hello, James.
Hello. Where are we going to start? Inter Roma? No Totti, no Ibra, but still plenty of excitements there.
I think that would be the obvious place to start, yeah. It was a funny game because you sort of feel like this is one of the biggest games in the Italian football calendar, and it's a really important time because Inter 9 points ahead. But it really sort of felt like coming into it, like it was almost no one was even really talking about it. Everyone was still sort of dwelling on what happened in the Champions League. That sort of really overshadowed it for a lot of people in Italy, because Roma was sort of building up this season, talking about, oh, this is the year when the final's in Roma, so we can try and do it. And Inter had this big, you know, we have to prove who we are against Manchester United. And we suddenly got to this game, and it was as if there'd been no build-up to it at all. And it kicked off, and it seemed like Inter still didn't realise it was happening until about half-time, when they were 2-0 down. But absolutely fantastic second half, in which Mario Balotelli basically took over the game for about half an hour, scored one goal, and then won a penalty, which he slotted home himself as well. Inter still managed to concede another goal in the middle of this, because at half-time, Mourinho had taken off Burdisso and Maxwell and brought on Vieira and Figo. So they were playing a sort of hybrid between a 4-3-2-1 and a 3-3-3-1. Sorry, a 4-2-3-1 and a 3-3-3-1, because basically Cambiasso kept coming out of defence, so he only had three defenders.
Oh, that's all right, Paddy, go on.
But then
Jonathan Wilson arrived for a second.
But, you know, then you had this second penalty, got him back to 3-2, and then they brought Hernan Crespo off the bench, who hadn't scored all season, and when the 90 seconds are coming on, he equalised for him. So, cracking game, leaves Inter, Inter still 7 points clear at the top, and I think it's probably still fairly safely in hand for them at the moment. Although they've got a tricky trip to Genoa next week.
Well, they've got a tricky trip to Genoa next week, and then they got a trip to Turin, of course, in April, to face Juventus with the team 7 points behind. We've seen Inter collapse in similar circumstances.
I think the bigger deal at the moment is that, yes, Inter might drop a few more points for the end of the season, but is anyone really looking like they're going to overtake them? I mean, Juventus did win this weekend. They beat Napoli 1-0, but they're not playing convincing football at the moment. Milan definitely aren't going to catch them, because they lost again this week in Sampdoria. In fact, Milan are now more worried about staying in the top four than they are about chasing the title. So, you know, it's a two-horse race, and, you know, you've got one horse that's some way out in front and playing better, and you've got to imagine that they're going to hold on.
We should give a big shout out to Catania. We mentioned the Sicilian derby going into the weekend, and Catania went to Palermo and had their first win there in 16 years, and not just a win, but a 4-0 drubbing of their Sicilian neighbours. Sadly, their fans weren't there to see it, but it was a spectacular game, Paolo.
Yeah, their fans weren't there to see it, but 800 of them waited at a service station on the way back to Catania to greet the team bus, and another 400 at the Catania Stadium. They absolutely just destroyed Palermo. I mean, there was this wonder goal in the middle of it by Giuseppe Mascara, who, it's being referred to wonder goal. It is an incredibly impressive strike, but at the same time, it is a bit like, you do look at it and think, well, he has basically just hit it and hope. But Morimoto nodded the ball down to midfield. He didn't even let it touch the ground. He just had a dig from inside the
centre circle,
and straight over Amelia's head in the Palermo goal. And, you know, a great result for Catania, actually, not just their first win in Palermo in a long time, but their first win away from home since, I think, last April, full stop. So, a big win for them in what many of them will consider to be the most important game of the season.
Well, 45 yards out. It was a bit like Matty Taylor's for Portsmouth a year or two ago. And, of course, by Mascara, so that means we can say, you couldn't make it up. And he lashed it in.
One in the eye.
He gave excellent, Paolo. Good that you're here, because as we now turn our attention to the midweek games, obviously we covered one of the two of these back in part one. I wanted to know, West Brom are taking on Arsenal, who've now notched up, 4 straight 0-0s in the Premier League. Mm. They did score a goal.
Broken up by one penalty in the Champions League.
Right. Now, if they don't win any trophies and they've now not even got the beautiful game to console them, where does that leave Arsenal?
Well, it's a question that I suppose a lot of Arsenal fans are asking. I mean, I think the problem you've got at Arsenal at the moment is that a lot of the crowd really have turned on them in a big way, actually. You know, there is a really, like, having, you know, I've gone to Arsenal for a number of years, as the most of the people in the pod know, and I've never felt the atmosphere being like it is at the moment. It really is sort of people getting on the players every time anything goes wrong in a way that I've not experienced before. I think Raphael wants to jump in here. So
no, continue. I'll jump in after.
Why can't they score, Paolo?
Well, I think the problem you've got at the moment is it's just basically entirely reliant on Robin van Persie to score goals. Without Adebayor, with Bentner playing, you know, as Bentner plays, and Carlos Vela is maybe people beginning to realise that he's not the saviour that he maybe appeared to be in the Carling Cup. And that's also completely unfair on him, because you can't expect a kid of his age to suddenly step in and carry this great big mantle. But there's just no one scoring goals outside of Robin van Persie. And you could see it on the weekend. He, you know, really just, you could see him rolling his eyes at his teammates on more than one occasion. He's clearly frustrated with it. But, you know, he was never the, he was never the player who was necessarily the most prolific. I mean, he scores a fair few, but he's not a goal poacher supreme who's going to score, you know, a goal every two games necessarily a lot of the time. And that's a big issue because there's just nothing coming from midfield.
I just think it's really interesting. I mean, I have a lot of time for Arsene Wenger, but I think it's almost patronising that he still comes out and wants to discuss the style of the opposition after every consecutive nil-nil draw. And he made a point of, oh, Fulham, they actually played. Well done. Thank you. I'm curious to see whether Tony Mowbray will come out on Tuesday and say, oh, well done, Arsenal. It's only nil-nil, but they really played well. They really tried. And what can you expect? It's only Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Wenger is, you know, partly to blame for the scoring less goals in that he's certainly playing his fullbacks more defensively than he had earlier in the season. I think that's a response in itself to maybe not being as tight as the back. Tight at the back as they wanted to be, but you know, I just think there's problems there which that greater than can be easily fixed.
I think Arsenal West Brom is a fascinating fixture because two teams who have this reputation for playing lovely, beautiful football that is thoroughly undeserved because neither of them actually do anymore. Whatever about last season, so yeah, could be another nil-nil ahoy.
I will say one thing, which is that Andre Arshavin has come straight in and looks a real player. He looks like he's going to be a good signing. I mean, he definitely tired towards the end of the Fulham game, but he was, you know, beyond Van Persie, the one player you thought might actually do something for Arsenal the weekend.
Excellent. Spurs taking on Borough, losing there in big trouble, potentially, Spurs. But Borough have had their good game of the season, so presumably they're not going to be worried too much about that. No thoughts on that one. Excellent. So we'll move straight on to, let's see. Oh, Man City, Aston Villa. High potential for disaster there.
It can't be more disastrous than the away shirts that they played in.
What, Man City?
Yeah.
The orange and black thing, yeah. And Craig Bellamy's now injured. Now, he'd been their star signing, really, of January, had he not?
He's done well.
Mm.
Yeah.
He has done well. I wrote a blog when they signed him, poo-pooing the whole thing. But there's always the worry that he's going to get injured, and now he is injured because he is an injury-prone player. At the time of recording, we don't know how serious his injury is because he's getting a scan on it today in Harley Street or somewhere. But if he's ruled out, City would be in big, big trouble.
Right, and Robinho apparently is too busy sucking his thumb and everyone's fed up with him and they want to unload him. Offload him to Chelsea.
What is it about Brazilians in the Premier League? They just seem to have a bit of an attitude problem.
It's not just in the Premier League. I don't think Adriano has necessarily gone down that well all the time he's been in Italy. So
they just don't like it down south, these Man City players. That's why they lost in London. No, but what about... But you said they're in big trouble, City, but are they? I mean, this is a season that's just completely meaningless, isn't it, domestically? They can't go up, they can't go down, they're not going anywhere.
There are only 6 points off the bottom three, but I admit it does look unlikely that they would be sucked back into the relegation battle. But there you go. Man City taking on Aston Villa on a Wednesday. We should mention, I know we talked about Newcastle Man United at the start, Rio Ferdinand. Tell us the owl-based news.
Well, Rio Ferdinand is getting married to his long-term partner in August.
Sound of hearts breaking all over England.
I would imagine the ladies would be devastated to hear this news. But in the church they're getting married in, somewhere in Cheshire, the plan is that his wedding rings, or the wedding rings, will be delivered in a velvet pouch by an owl. And I told you this morning, and you greeted me with a similar gobsmacked silence to the one you're greeting with now. Which I don't think is contrived.
An owl.
An owl, yes. Apparently, this Ollie the owl, it's a she owl.
Oh.
Well, obviously, if she's minding the rings, she'll be able to see any potential thieves coming from a 360-degree angle.
But what if an errant dormouse, or church mouse, indeed, distracts her attention?
That's the thing. You could end up with Rio's wife having a desiccated garden vole placed on her finger instead of a ring.
I think they've got to watch out for any local magpies in the area because they'll have those rings away as soon as look at them.
But apparently this owl has delivered wedding rings in a velvet pouch on 6 different occasions and nothing has gone wrong yet.
Right.
But the potential for catastrophe.
I'm just surprised. If you're a Premier League player, you'd think they'd want, you know, the rings brought out in a pit bull's or something like that. Or
naked, a page three model on a motorcycle. Or
with one on each nipple.
Jay-Z in a Hummer, something like that.
It does
something
sound like a very classy affair with the owl.
But apparently the way the owl knows, the best man stands, who'd probably be Wayne Rooney or Gary Neville or someone, will be standing with a falconry glove on his hand, and the owl's trainer will be sort of hiding behind the altar waving a bit of turkey. And then the owl flies down from the organ balcony, having seen the turkey, lands on the falconry glove, at which point Rio will take the bag from around its neck and produce the rings. I'd go for winged monkeys myself.
He wants. Rio will have to be careful when he tries to take the ring back off the owl, because they can give you a nasty nip if you're not careful.
Could have your eye out.
Could be owls of disapproval at Rio's wedding.
But he is a talented player.
I'm just glad
which
he
indeed
had...
is an owl appropriate noise.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. He's getting married to who?
He had.
That was Barry's owl
he
impression.
He had the wit to woo his girlfriend, and now he's marrying her.
And I think on that note, we can conclude today's Football Weekly. That's funny because that's what owls do. That's the noise they make. Excellent stuff. Barry Glendinny, many, many thanks.
You're welcome.
John Ashdown, equally so.
Thanks, Jimbo.
Dankeschön. Rathornixon. And grazie mille, Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
Yeah. And the incredible array of top production people who are glaring at us and saying, can we go now? From the other side of the glass screen in this exciting new pod. Many thanks. Hope it sounded all right there, listeners. You can never tell with this newfangled machinery. And we'll be back on Thursday. So do join us then.